Hello and welcome to Blogging Heads TV, another edition of the Middle East. This one, the one-year anniversary edition of the Arab Spring. I'm Gregory Gause. I teach political science at the University of Vermont.
Hi, Greg. How you doing? Good to be on with you again. I think the last time we talked was September, so quite a bit has happened since then. Let me just start by introducing myself. Though, before we get going, my name is Shadi Hamid. I'm the Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. My focus, research-wise, is democratization of the Arab world and the role of Islamist movements. So with that, Greg, if you want to get us started.
Sure. Hi, Shadi. Nice to see you again, even though someday, Shadi, you and I have to meet personally.
Okay. Well, it hadn't even occurred to me. We actually haven't met in person. It's hard to believe.
Exactly. So, on to the show. It seems to me that 1 year into the Arab Spring, it's worth asking the question from an American point of view, an American foreign policy point of view, good for America, bad for America. What do you think?
Well, it's a big question. I think the jury's still out, and I think how we respond in the coming months and years will help us ultimately answer that question. But I think the short answer is yes. I think this is good for America. I think it should be good for America. Whether or not policymakers will feel the same way, I think that might be a question. But, finally, the region is changing, and I think it's changing in a direction that is certainly in line with American ideals. We're a country that claims to support democratic values and ideals, not just at home, but throughout the world. And this finally, after many decades of waiting, is happening. And Arabs have proven that they want democracy just as much as everyone, and they're willing to die in the thousands, if not more, for their freedom. I think that's something that should be great for America and great for Americans. And I think we should be, I don't want to say celebrating, because the Arab Spring is not a totally good thing, as you yourself have written many times, but we should be happy to see this change happening.
Right. I take a different view of it. I think certainly in terms of short-term interests, it hasn't been good for the United States. I think that, we got along very well with many of these autocratic regimes, Hosni Mubarak being the most important of those. And I think that democratic regimes in the Arab world, even though they might be better for their own publics, and I don't deny that whatsoever, and I accept everything you said about the desire in the Arab world for democracy, but I think they're going to be harder to deal with on American foreign policy issues regarding Israel, regarding our military presence, regarding a whole range of things. So maybe it's time for the United States to rethink some of those elements of its policy, but that rethinking, of course, will be very, very difficult. Even though I'm the one who asked you the question, I have to say that when I think about it, it's the wrong question to ask. I look at the Arab Spring, and I don't mean this pejoratively, I mean it only as an analogy. I look at the Arab Spring like a flood or a hurricane, right? You don't ask whether you're for the flood or against the flood, or for the hurricane or against the hurricane, or is the hurricane good or bad. You deal with it. It changes the landscape, and you deal with it. But there's one element of the landscape that I want to push you on here, because you said the American ideals of democracy are being implemented in the Arab world, and I think that in Tunisia and in Egypt, that's certainly true. But they're leading to at least short-term results that could be, while democratic, not liberal. And we know that Americans tend to conflate democracy and liberalism. But you can have an illiberal democracy, to use Fareed Zakaria's term. And do you think that how do you think that balance is going to work in a more democratic Middle East, which at least in the short term we see as a more Islamist Middle East?
Sure. Well, before I get to that, Greg, let me just take you up on this issue of interests versus ideals. Now, it's certainly true that it's going to hurt some of our interests in the short run, but I think in the long run, this development is good not just for our ideals, but for American national security interests, because I don't think the old autocratic allies were good for the U.S., and they led to a number of serious problems. I think the rise of extremism and terrorism, I think, was at least in part a product of these stagnant regimes that didn't respond to their own people's needs and desires. I think even if you look at the peace treaties with Israel, I think a lot of that was illusory because these were cold pieces, and they were decided by a group of autocratic leaders, and they don't have legitimacy among the population at large. The list goes on. I just don't see how this ultimately was good for us. And I believe that autocratic regimes, by definition, are temporary, meaning they will at some point in the future fall. So that makes them inherently unstable. I believe in stable countries. I think that's better for everyone. But the only way to have stable countries is if they have the consent of their own people, if they are popularly legitimate. And the only way to have that is through democracy. So for that reason, I think it's great in the long run for U.S. interests. I don't know if you want to push back on that, though.
Yeah, both analytically and politically, I'll push back on that because, you know, the military ran Egypt from 1952 until maybe 2012. One can argue that in the land of the pyramids, this is a blink of an eye. But in terms of actually making policy, the military regime in Egypt was a pretty stable regime, right? It lasted 60 years. And I think you deal with governments on a foreign policy level, you deal with governments that are in power. And if they want to make peace with Israel, great. And you encourage them to do that because it sets markers. And while I agree that the peace with Israel is not popular in the Arab countries that have signed treaties, Egypt and Jordan, it sets down a marker that will be more difficult for even popularly elected governments to back away from. The question about legitimacy, which I think is a slippery word because I haven't really found any way to measure it, and I don't mean measure it numerically, but just measure it. What's a legitimate regime? What's not a legitimate regime? Until the regime falls, then you know it's illegitimate. Nobody would say Bashar al-Assad's regime is legitimate today. But would you have said that about Hafez al-Assad in 1990?
Yes. All autocratic regimes are illegitimate by definition.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So the Saudis are illegitimate.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Should we not deal with them because they're illegitimate?
That's never been my position. I mean, I don't deny reality. I don't deny that there are regimes in power that aren't going to disappear tomorrow, and we have to find a way to work with them. My argument has always been that we should use our leverage, we should use those relationships to push those regimes to get serious about political reform. And obviously in different countries, there will be different speeds. And I think Saudi Arabia is one place that will take probably longer than the others. But I do think as a matter of principle that we should use our leverage with these regimes to urge them and when appropriate, push them towards democracy.
Yeah, and my take on that is that we have a whole raft of issues with the Saudis, and if we start off with political reform, we don't get to any of the others. But let me get back to this issue that we talked about liberalism and democracy. So we get these Islamist regimes, right? 75% of the seats in the Egyptian parliament, approximately, won by people who, you know, are Islamists of various varieties, but Islamists. And you know, when we have this scare tactic in the United States that Newt Gingrich and other politicians are talking about the dangers of Sharia law and all this nonsense, right? But it does, I think, reflect the idea that many, many Americans see Islamists, even popularly elected Islamists, as fundamentally illiberal. And thus, they don't see American values being implemented, and they worry about that. How would you respond to that?
I mean, they're right. The Brotherhood is not liberal. It's Islamist. And if it was liberal, it wouldn't have won as many.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a strong constituency in the Arab world for illiberalism. I don't think that Arabs have to be liberal if they don't want to be. I don't think we as Americans have the right, or it's really our place to demand that other people be liberal. I just don't buy that. And my fundamental issue is whether people or countries are democratic. And
right.
If Egyptians want to vote for communists, socialists, Islamists, Salafis, I don't have a problem with that. And I think if there's something very patronizing when we just automatically assume that when people are free, they're naturally going to move towards some ideal form of liberalism. That's just not the case. And I think it's something that we have to come to terms with. Not everyone wants to be just like us, and that's fine. And I think I think you're right when you
said... Isn't that amazing?
I think there's a tension, but I think you're right to point to a tension between liberalism and democracy. A country can become more democratic and at the same time more illiberal. And for example, let's say that some Islamist party wants to implement a law banning alcohol, and they do it through the parliamentary process of parliament, which is elected by the people. That is fundamentally, in my view, a democratic thing to do, but it is also not liberal. So there's a tension there, and I think in a sense like that, it becomes quite clear. Ultimately, as uncomfortable as I am with governments interfering in the personal decisions of citizens, I think democracy should be our priority. And I think democracy, in some sense, is value neutral. And I'm always uncomfortable with this idea of Americans imposing their cultural values on other people.
Yeah, and here you and I agree. Although I think that we could argue about why is it that the U.S. should push democracy but not liberalism, because it seems to me we're interfering as much on the democracy side. But I agree. Once these democracies are set, it's none of our business, basically, to tell them how to govern their countries. You know, you hit on the raw nerve with me with alcohol. I spend some amount of time in the Middle East and would hate to not be able to have a beer. After a hot day in Cairo. But if that's the way the Egyptians decide to vote, it's not my place to tell them not to. I think the alcohol one is not nearly as neuralgic for Americans, though, as women's rights issues.
Yeah.
Because there we have a clear policy that, stated by the Obama administration very directly by a female Secretary of State, coming after a female Secretary of State in the George W. Bush administration, that women's rights are going to be a central part of the American human rights agenda. And here the illiberalism of elected Islamist governments might run directly against what many people in the United States who are sympathetic to the cause of democracy in the Muslim world and in the Arab world might find really hard to swallow. I'm with you. If elected governments in Egypt and Tunisia want to change the rules in terms of women's rights issues, moving more toward Islamic law, implementations on personal status issues of divorce and remarriage and all that, I've got no problem with that. But I think many people in America will.
No, I think there's no doubt about that. My position on that would be, yes, let's support women's empowerment in that kind of more general sense. But again, gender equality as we understand it in the West, again, that doesn't have a large constituency in a place like Egypt. That's just the way it is. And I think there's going to be widespread resistance to that sort of thing. Now, I don't know what we do about that. I think that we can kind of urge on the margins, but I don't think that should be one of the fundamental determinants of our policy in a place like Egypt, because again, that runs counter to democratization. If the majority of Egyptians are really socially conservative and want to, do some things that we're going to disagree with, I think we both agree that that's not really our place. So I think it's sort of putting the cart before the horse. Or is it the other way around? I'm not sure. But in making women's rights the primary thing, I think these things will come in their own time. I think there's a natural progression for societies. the fundamental priority in Egypt now should be a transition to civilian rule, elected institutions, separation of powers, checks and balances, the fundamental building blocks of any democratic society. And I worry that when we focus a lot on issues like women's rights, we alienate important constituencies in a place like Egypt. And we also kind of show that maybe we're not fully in tune with what Egyptian priorities are at a given time.
Yeah, and my position on this is very, very similar. You know, once these governments are installed, it's not our business to tell them how to run their domestic affairs. Again, we've got a number of issues with Egypt, from the relations with Israel, relations with the Palestinian Authority, our military connections with Egypt, which are intense and variegated, and these other issues, which will make headlines and alienate many people in the United States and in the U.S. Congress, to me should go down the ladder. But let's move on from these more from the cases where we've already had democratic transitions, at least somewhat, to the headline case these days, which is Syria, where we're having, I don't know why people are afraid to call this a civil war. It seems to me to be an open civil war between the regime and a large percentage of the population of Syria. I know that you've published on the Atlantic Monthly's website, as I recall, a piece on Syria. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that, and then I'll push back in my non-interventionist mode.
Oh boy, I'm going to get in trouble now, I think.
That was my purpose, Shadi, to get you in trouble.
Yeah, so I wrote this piece that came out last week. I think some people are simplifying the piece as being some outright call for war in Syria. That's not the idea. In fact, I've been fairly torn about this issue, which is why I didn't write about it earlier, and I spent many months debating, you know, is military intervention something we should consider? So I acknowledge that. I acknowledge being torn right at the outset of the article. At the end of the day, though, I think it's something we have to consider seriously, that we've waited a long time. It's been more than 300 days into the Syrian uprising. We've tried nearly everything: diplomacy, negotiation, mediation, Arab League mission, talking to Assad, not talking to Assad, sanctions, travel bans, God knows what else. It hasn't worked, and the killing has intensified. So I think there comes a point where you have to say, enough is enough. What are the alternatives? So I think we're not quite at the point today where we should launch the military option, but I do think it's coming very soon. And I think we have to prepare and consider what the options available to us are, whether it be the establishment of safe zones, humanitarian corridors, arming the opposition, not arming them, whatever it might be. I think this is a conversation that we as a policy community have to have right now, and we have to prepare for the real possibility of military intervention. Now that's where I come out on it. It's a difficult thing. I don't take the idea of military intervention lightly. No one should, especially after Iraq. And Iraq should haunt us. Iraq should affect the way that we think about this. But there comes a time where you have to do the right thing. And I think when people are being massacred, and we had this conversation many months ago about Libya, I think the international community has a responsibility to protect. That's a UN established norm. It's a norm I think we should encourage.
Yeah. I'm still not convinced that the weight of either our interest or our moral obligations call for a military intervention in Syria. I'm haunted by the what I consider to be the enormous American error of military intervention in Iraq. As somebody I know well and who knows the Middle East well said to me when we were talking about the prospects of Syria, he said, Bashar al-Assad has killed 5,000-6,000 of his own people, and that's horrible. But after the American invasion of Iraq, you know, over 100,000 Iraqis, at the most conservative estimates, died. Now, it's not the same morally. I understand that, that Bashar al-Assad is killing his people. The United States basically created a situation in which, you know, well over 100,000 Iraqi civilians were killed, but it didn't pull the trigger on every one of them. But still, we created a situation that led to, you know, some good things. The end of Saddam Hussein is not a bad thing, but also some horrible results. And I worry that in Syria, as ham-handed as we are, and as ignorant as we are of the on-the-ground realities in the Arab world, we could be setting ourselves up for a similar thing. Because I know that you know, when you look at these things, you know, just going in and setting up a humanitarian corridor, you know, might be a first step, but it rarely is the last step, right? I mean, the more you get in militarily, the more you find yourself fighting the regime. That certainly happened in Libya, right? What began as a mission, at least justified on responsibility to protect the citizens in Benghazi, led to a fight against the Gaddafi regime. I can't imagine a military intervention, even safe areas and humanitarian corridors that might be authorized by the UN in Syria would not lead very quickly to a fight against the Syrian regime, and you know, the results of which, you know, might be clean, you know, relatively easy the way Libya was, or might not be. I personally don't think that it's in the United States' interest or a moral obligation to get involved militarily in Syria. Yeah. Acknowledging how bad the Assad regime is and how much it's doing bad things to its own people. But I'm not convinced that America has to be there. Now, if the Turks want to go in and establish a safe zone, it's not that I'm going to oppose that. But I just don't think American forces should be used in another Middle Eastern country, in effect, to change another Middle Eastern regime.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, I'm not calling for this being some kind of U.S. thing where we go in and it becomes, you know, our thing. It has to have broad-based support. It has to be the international community acting in a more coordinated fashion. And what I have in mind here would be the Turks, the Qataris, France, Britain, and the U.S. being the major powers involved, and any others who would like to also join. But it can't have a predominant U.S. footprint, and I take that, you know, I don't have a problem with that acknowledgement. And there has to be some Arab and Muslim ownership over it, and I think Turkey has been thinking seriously about establishing a safe zone. It's already supporting an armed rebellion through the Free Syria Army, so some of this is already happening anyway. I think that this is another reason why it's different than Iraq, is because if we don't, we have to think about what happens if we don't do anything. And the Assad regime is not going to fall on its own. I think this is a regime that is more durable for a variety of reasons, and they're going to fight to the very last drop of blood. So with that in mind, I worry that not only are we already in a civil war by the normal political science definitions, but the civil war is likely to intensify and get worse, and we might see a much wider scale loss of life, and it's already been quite high. So I think we have to look and say, if we let things go as they are, it could be disastrous, not just for the Syrians, but for the stability of the region, for U.S. interests writ large in the region. So that's what we have to be thinking about. Iraq, I think, was entirely different because there wasn't a mass slaughter taking place in 2003. That wasn't even the pretext for intervention. It was about WMDs. I just think it's such a different situation. And I just worry that we're always going to go back to fighting that last war, that Iraq should haunt us, but we also shouldn't conflate Iraq with subsequent military interventions.
Let me just push one more time on Syria on the details. You said, and I think rightly so, that this is not a regime that's going to fall on its own particularly easily or particularly quickly. It's been fighting It's been fighting for its life now for what, 7 months, 8 months, 10 months, I guess.
Yeah.
And it shows no sign of cracking. It seems to me that this would be a hard thing, Shadi, to get rid of this regime. You have a military that is tied to the regime with bonds of ethnicity and sectarianism, not ethnicity, but sectarianism. You know, the Alawi Officer Corps and some of these units, the 4th Division particularly, that seem to be almost completely Alawi. And it seems to me that unlike Egypt and Tunisia, where the armies basically split from the regimes because the army had a sense of its own corporate identity and a sense of its own interests independent of the regimes, you're not going to see that in Syria, and we haven't yet. So you're talking about, you know, fighting a real army to get rid of this regime, which, you know, I'm not saying that if the United States decided to fight the Syrian army could put up much of a fight, but it's not a regime that's going to fall easily, which draws us, and even though you say an international coalition, we're gonna be doing a lot of the heavy lifting on this, it seems to me, if it gets down to actual military boots on the ground. I mean, the Turks will certainly play a role, but you know, we're gonna be there, and it just seems like we could be involved in another situation where we have taken out a bad regime and then don't know what to do, and who knows what happens. I don't see American interests as being sufficiently engaged here to draw the United States into yet another war against a Muslim country.
So let me just add another caveat.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I know things that I don't. I'm not an expert on military affairs. It's not for me to judge whether or not a particular military option will be feasible. But I do think military experts and policymakers should be laying out a variety of different plans and seeing, does any have the success of working? If the answer comes back and the answer is a definitive no, then I'm willing to respect that. Again, I think others can speak to that more than I can. And there are a variety of different options. Some are more limited than others. And so I think the first step should be at least contemplating it.
Go ahead.
I was going to make another point, John. That another reason why this is very different than Iraq, and when, you know, if people are curious about why I came out strongly in support of Libya and now Syria, I have a basic principle, and I talk about this in the article, that if protesters on the ground request us to come to their aid in their struggle, I think we do have, and by we here I mean the international community and not just the U.S., we do have a moral obligation to think about it seriously. Doesn't mean we have to do it, but I think we have to respect it. And I think there has been a gradual but unmistakable move in that direction, where Syrian activists on the ground and certainly the Syrian leadership of the Syrian National Council, which I think is the most important opposition body right now, have come out more and more in support of some kind of military option. Now, the fact that they're doing that means we have to take it seriously. If they weren't doing it, I wouldn't have written the article and I wouldn't have even have thought about it. I don't think that we should go in and impose and say, you need a military intervention. No, we should only consider it when asked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that precedent would set up a situation where we could be in lots of wars in lots of places. But let's move on to another, to a more general issue. I think we've elucidated our differences on this one.
Yeah, okay, sure.
Back to the more general issue of the Arab Spring, right? We've had a year, and we've had basically six countries in the Arab world undergo regime-shaking crises. Call them the six-pack of upheaval, or the six-pack of revolt, right? Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, and Bahrain. Different outcomes, right? Important transitional elections in Tunisia and Egypt. A brutal suppression in Bahrain. and you know, a muddle with who knows what in Yemen and a civil war in Syria. But it's interesting that you know, one of the characteristics of these upheavals is how quickly they spread horizontally in the Arab world, kind of reminding us that the Arab world is in some ways a political community across borders, and that Arabs look at what other Arabs are doing and are affected by it much more than say what's happening in Iran or Turkey or other places. But you know, the horizontal spread stopped at those six, right? And you know, there are interesting things happening in Morocco and Kuwait, and you know, but no regime shaking crises. Why do you think it stopped? Or do you? Let me rephrase that. Do you think it stops at the six pack, or do you think that there are other countries in the Arab world who, you know, not 5-10 years down the line, but this year might suffer a regime shaking crisis?
Yeah. Well, first of all, great. Let me just say that I think you've coined some of the most memorable phrases of the Arab Spring. I want to credit you with the Arab Winter of Discontent, which I think was
that
a
didn't
great.
That catch on, though.
I tried my best.
Me too.
And now the six pack. So I think we got two there. Anyway, you know, it's only been a year, and I think what we learned from Tunisia was that even if things seem impossible, they can become possible very quickly. And I'll just again, I think we probably talked about this before, but I'm not aware of any Middle East expert on the planet who predicted Tunisia. In fact, everyone was saying Tunisia was the most stable of the stable. So I think we should have some humility and say, well, just because it doesn't seem likely somewhere else doesn't mean it's not going to happen. So I'll just kind of put that out in front. I mean, that said, I think you're right that it did stop spreading, at least for now. And I think part of it is republics are very different than monarchies, and we have to recognize the institutional differentiation there, that with the republics, you had one hated leader, and the opposition, however fractious it was able to unify itself to oppose that leader. Now, in a place like Jordan or Morocco or many of the Gulf countries, you don't have that same sense of purpose, because who are you trying to bring down? No one in Jordan is saying King Abdullah must fall, because that's not really what they want. And actually, many of the opposition in a place like Jordan, as you know, actually see Abdullah as a legitimate unifying figure. They don't necessarily want to see him go. So what's your bumper sticker slogan then? You don't really have one. And I think that makes it very challenging for people to come together and have this common agenda. And also, these monarchies, some of them at least, have been very smart. And in Jordan and Morocco in particular, they've acknowledged popular grievances. They have made some reforms. I don't think they're particularly great, but at least they seem like they're real reforms. And so I think that helps absorb some of the anger. And I think that's the new model of dealing with Arab revolts, and it's probably the smartest one. I wouldn't want to, you know, tell too many people that, because I don't think it's good that you're absorbing that kind of dissent and stopping real change from happening. But I, you know, preemptive reform, that before people get really angry on the street, you give them a little bit of what they want. You give them more outlets to express their grievances. You give them some sense of hope, some sense of a political process that's moving in a positive direction, and then they probably won't revolt against you.
Yeah. I want to make two points on this. One is that there's this trope about monarchies being better able to handle upheaval than republics, and I think that's just wrong. I think that in the Moroccan case, you actually have real reform. I mean, the idea that the king is now committed constitutionally to call the leader of the largest faction party in parliament to be prime minister is a very important reform. I think it's probably the most important reform to come out of the Arab Spring in the countries outside the six-pack. But those other monarchies in the Gulf, they can't make those kinds of compromises because while the monarch in Morocco and in Jordan, they're single individuals. The monarchies in Saudi Arabia and the smaller states are family monarchies. And for the king or the prince, the emir or the sultan in these places to basically say, we're going to have elected parliaments and the majority faction in those elected parliaments will form the government.
Yeah.
Basically means that the rest of the family is cut out of power. I mean, we saw that in Bahrain in spades, I think.
Yeah.
If the king had been willing and able to get rid of his uncle, the prime minister, at the beginning of that of the popular demonstrations in Bahrain, I think the demonstrations would have ended. Even if he had appointed another al-Khalifa in the prime ministerial position. But either he couldn't or he wouldn't. And I think that that's the real distinction here. The other point that I would make about the horizontal spread, which was, you know, fascinating and reminds us, as I said before, the notion of an Arab community across borders, is oil. Right? One can argue that, oh, well, no monarchies suffered problems, you know, except Bahrain. No oil country except Libya suffered a regime-shaking crisis, right? When oil, you know, and this is Algeria, this is Iraq, it's not just the oil monarchies in the Gulf. When oil is at $100 a barrel, right, regimes have, you know, quite a bit of ready cash to be able to co-opt and repress popular upheaval. And it seems to me that we underappreciate the political economy of this. And while there is certainly a democratic wave in the Arab world that can't be denied and is going to have long-term impacts, we still have a lot of oil states where the ability of the executive, whether that executive is a prime minister like Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq or a king like King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia, the ability of the executive to deploy enormous amounts of money is something that militates against democratic reform.
Well, yeah, I mean that's certainly part of it. But again, I go back to this that, I mean, the Saudi regime is not going to last forever. So I think we're going to have to rethink the oil political economy argument in, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, or whenever it happens. So this is just stage one of this debate. Unless you do think that the Saudi regime could potentially last, permanently, which I don't think.
Yeah, nothing is permanent, and as Lord Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. But I just put out a piece with the Council on Foreign Relations, their Center for Preventive Action, on Saudi Arabia and the new Middle East. And my argument there is that I think that the Saudi regime is pretty stable in the medium term. As long as oil prices sustain the level where they are now or approximately,
right,
the Saudis will have the wherewithal to maintain the patronage networks that they've developed, and they've taken on a lot of new obligations, financial obligations, as a result of the Arab Spring to co-opt and deflect the Arab Spring in their own country.
Yeah, but what about some of the troubling ingredients? I mean, youth unemployment is at astronomical levels in Saudi Arabia. I mean, some numbers as high as 40%. There is a real gap between the rich and the poor, or the rich and the less rich, whatever you want to call them. I mean, there are serious grievances, and the list is long in Saudi Arabia. It's not like some of the other Gulf states. So I don't know. I think some of the ingredients are there. And when King Abdullah passes away, I think there's going to be serious questions about the new leadership and whether that new leader can command the same level of respect and admiration as the current king does.
Right. I actually think that you're right that Saudi Arabia suffers from many of the same social and economic problems that we see as triggers for upheaval in other parts of the Arab world. I think one of the differences is on youth unemployment, for example. For Saudis in their 20s, yes, youth unemployment is very, very high. You know, I've seen figures up to 30%. But it declines, and once you get into your 30s, unemployment in Saudi Arabia is actually very low, you know, below below 10%, I think even below 5%. Mm. I talk about this in the piece. So partially it's you know, you might be unemployed when you're 26, but you know you're going to get a job eventually. As long as the Saudis can keep doing that, I think that the youth unemployment issue is not as serious as it was in Tunisia or Egypt, where, you know, you were unemployed when you were 26, and you saw no hope when you're 30 of getting a job. But on the leadership question, and I don't want to belabor the Saudi case too much, but to me the leadership issue in Saudi Arabia is not the individual. It's not King Abdullah, as popular as he is. I mean, to me it's generational. As long as you have this older generation, you know, the king in his late 80s, his crown prince in his late 70s, early 80s, I think that the system is pretty stable because these guys have worked together for a long time. Of course, they have their differences. To me, the real leadership issue in Saudi Arabia comes when you have to go to the next generation, because you have no template or precedent for how to shift down to the next generation. That, I think, is going to be the dicey one. But I actually think that the Saudis are in pretty good shape for the medium term. And so we'll see. But if just to shift briefly, you know, we talked about where there might be real problems this year. And I would highlight two places that I think bear special viewing. And one is Jordan.
Okay.
Because there we haven't seen the kinds of reforms that we've seen in Morocco. And Jordan doesn't have the kind of money, although it's collecting a lot of money from Saudi Arabia these days, doesn't have the kind of money to deploy that the oil monarchs do. And the king is an interesting figure, but I think in many ways he's alienated some of the historical constituency of the monarchy, right? East Bank Jordanians.
Yeah.
Without developing an alternative. So I think that Jordan is very interesting. The other place that I'm keeping a particular eye on, and maybe this would be a good place for us to end up here, is you can give us, you know, where countries to keep an eye on. The other country I'm keeping an eye on is Bahrain. Because even though the regime is entrenched and basically implemented a security solution with the help of the Saudis and other Gulf monarchs
to put down the popular upheavals. It seems to me that this is not over
in Bahrain. We're going to come up on your anniversary of February 14th,
uprising around the Bahrain.
And it seems to me that the opposition has become very polarized, sectarian. So we'll talk about the Shia opposition in Bahrain, even though the movement in Bahrain started as a cross-sectarian movement. The Shia opposition, I don't think, is over. And my fear is that it could turn much more violent, matching the violence of the regime. And the reason that this is of particular concern to American policymakers, or should be, is the Fifth Fleet in Manama. So I think those are the two countries I keep an eye on.
Okay, those are good ones to watch. On Jordan, and actually wrote a recent paper for Brookings suggestively titled "How Stable is Jordan?" ? So I dealt with some of these issues. But I think Jordan is particularly interesting because it has a kind of sectarian divide that Palestinians form a slight majority over the indigenous Jordanians. So that kind of adds a different...
Let's call that ethnic, so as not to confuse my students.
Okay.
So, Palestinian, Jordanian, they're all Muslims. Not all of them, but most of them are Muslims, the grand majority. So it's not sectarian. Call it national.
But sectarian, actually, not to get into the definition of the word, but sectarian can also apply to non-religious differentiation. Anyway, we don't have
Oh, my God, I have to change my syllabus. Okay, go ahead.
I don't see change. I think Jordan is potentially a powder keg, and I think it has some very troubling ingredients. I think in the medium term there could be serious issues, but I think for now the opposition runs into the same problem. It's a divided opposition. It doesn't have a unity of purpose. It's failed, I think, to take advantage of the discontent. And there have been, I think, reforms, I would say, and I think you would probably say as well, that they've been disappointing and haven't gotten to where they need to be. But I still think there is a sense among a large portion of the population that the king is trying to push a little bit on reform. I don't buy it, but I think my sense is that in Jordan, a lot of people still do buy it. The question is, when are they going to lose trust in that? Because this king has been promising reform nonstop for years, since he really came to power in the late 1990s. And his father was promising democracy starting in 1989. This is the longest democratic transition that hasn't led to anything that we've seen in recent memory. I mean, we're talking about 22 years here. So I think Jordan is a country, and I agree with you, the U.S., the international community, they shouldn't buy all this talk that Jordan is a progressive model for reform. It isn't. It isn't. As for Bahrain, I think we're on the same page on that. Bahrain is an absolute powder keg, and it's the one place where I think history will look very unkindly on the Obama administration, because you can make an argument that there was at least an effort on the part of the Obama administration to be somewhat in line with popular aspirations in various countries like Egypt, Tunisia, maybe even Syria. Not so in Bahrain, and I think it's sad. It really is sad, and I think it's a very obvious point that people can say, look, the U.S. is engaging in utter hypocrisy, and I think on Bahrain we are.
We could talk about Bahrain for an hour. I think Feltman, the Assistant Secretary of State, was in Bahrain trying to do a deal right before the Saudi and other Gulf troops.
Yes,
back in March, and I think that the administration just basically said, we've got so much on our plate, we're not gonna push the Saudis in Bahrain. And one, we can argue about whether that was good or bad, but I think that this might be a good place to bring us to a close. We've told people to keep an eye on Jordan and Bahrain, and my guess is that we'll have plenty to talk about down the line. So nice talking to you, Shadi, and
great
look forward to talking again.
Sounds good. Right, okay, bye-bye. Greg. Talk to you soon. Bye.